This is the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, a podcast dude, and an all-around functional nerd. I'm here to talk about Mile High Con 47, my local con, which takes place each year at the Denver Tech Center sometime in October, once it actually fell on my birthday, and Rose and crew greeted me with cupcakes and party hats. This year, it's from October 23rd through the 25th, and to learn more about Mile High Con, I suggest you go check out their brand spanking new website, www.milehighcon.org. I'm also thinking that Mile High Con, at this point on the podcast, needs its own jingle, so I'll have to talk to Anelio about that. My guest tonight is the Toastmaster from Mile High Con 47. His name is James Van Pelt, and Jim teaches high school and college English in Western Colorado. His fiction has made numerous appearances in most of the major science fiction and fantasy magazines. He has been a finalist for a Nebula Award, the Colorado Blue Spruce Young Adult Book Award, and been reprinted in many of the year's best collections. His first novel, Summer of the Apocalypse, was released in 2006. His third collection of stories, The Radio Magician and Other Stories, received the Colorado Book Award in 2010. And his latest collection, Flying in the Heart of the Lafayette Escadrille?
Yes.
Was released in October of 2012. Dude, I'm sorry, Jim. I should have told you beforehand. I can't pronounce anything. His new young adult novel, Pandora's Gun, was released at Spokane Worldcon, Sasquan. And James blogs over at jimvanpelt.livejournal.com. Jim, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for asking. Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being Toastmaster. That's a heavy gig.
Well, it was exciting when I was asked. I've been going to Mile High Con since 1996, haven't missed any, and to be a part of the show itself, to be, you know, it's something I've had so much fun doing, to be a part of making it fun for somebody else is really exciting to be asked.
Oh, yeah. So last year it was Jean Stein, and she and I chatted a little bit about it. Why don't you tell folks what's involved with being a Toastmaster?
Well, that's kind of a flexible job, but I'll get to introduce the guests of honor. At the beginning, I have an opportunity to be a part of the masquerade, I think. There will be my own hour where I'll get to do anything I want with it. Mostly, I think the Toastmaster is a sort of figurehead, maybe a way to start the convention off on a fun note, I hope. We'll see. I've seen different Toastmasters be more or less involved in the convention. It's such a good convention, and it runs so smoothly. Because the people that run it have been doing such a good job for so long that it's hard to believe that the Toastmaster could screw it up. But I want to make sure I'm not the one that screws it up.
Of course. So you mentioned the masquerade and you thought that maybe you have something to do with it. You do. You are the guy who stands at the podium and calls off all the people when they come up on stage.
Yeah, marvelous opportunity to mispronounce names.
It is, yes. And last year I was the co-moderator of the masquerade because Jean wanted help.
With the names?
Yes. And she was afraid that she wouldn't recognize costumes. So that's actually the only time I've ever worn a pseudo costume at a convention. I ordered a Star Trek science blue polo and I stood next to her as her first officer.
What? You didn't go for the red shirt?
No. No, I wanted to come out of there alive. So Toastmaster doesn't mean you just get to spend all your time in the bar.
No, that's not that kind of Toastmaster.
Okay. And you do get an hour to do pretty much anything you want. Is that in the big room?
The ones that I've gone to, they put them in the bigger rooms, yes.
Okay.
And I think it depends a little bit on the popularity of the Toastmaster, whether you fill that room or not.
Sure.
I think Carrie Vaughn was Toastmaster one year, and she attracts such a great crowd because she's so interesting and entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last year she was wearing a Lisa Hayes costume from Robotech.
I don't think I saw that. I do get to see some of the costumes that she makes. She's a pretty, not necessarily a costumer, but sort of the Society for Creative Anachronism. She's likes that look.
Yes. And I got extra points because I recognized that she was Lisa Hayes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you would get big points from her on that.
Well, I was a big Robotech nerd, so that was my show. I still have the DVDs over here. I had the Beyond the Trope podcast folks who are also here in the Denver area. I had them over for dinner one night, and then we recorded a podcast. And I found out one of them, Michelle, is huge into Robotech. And so I had to show her that I had the digitally remastered DVDs. So you get to do a lot of stuff. You get to talk to people. You get to kind of announce things and sort of drive the con from opening to close.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
And we'll have to fight my inner introvert to do that, but I think I can maintain for that long. I just have to pretend that I'm teaching.
There you
so,
go.
So yeah. When I'm in front of the classroom, I'm filled with energy. When I go to parties, I hide in corners. So I have to tell myself it's not a party. It's an opportunity to mix. I'm better when I have a mission. And I think being Toastmaster gives me a mission.
That's awesome. So... there was something that you said that triggered a question in my head, and now I've sort of kind of lost it, which is sad. But that happens. You know, it's not like the listeners haven't heard me just sort of ramble and sort of sputter and die before. I know what it was. 1996.
Yes.
I've been going to Mile High Con since 1996. So that's what?
Yes.
That's 11 years? No, 9 years.
No,
10 years. 9 years. 9 years this year.
It's 2016. Your math is really
I went to a public high school in Fresno. So
oh no!
It's horrible. So 20 years.
Yeah, pretty close.
Wow. Wow.
And it was my second convention altogether. I went to WorldCon in Anaheim in '96 in August, and that was the first convention I'd ever been to.
Really?
So that was amazing. And then a friend of mine in Grand Junction, where I live, said, oh, you need to come to Mile High, because he'd always gone. And I decided that I would go. I had thought conventions before. This is pretty late. 1996, I was 42. I'd never been to a convention. I knew nothing about the fanish part of science fiction. I'd been a reader. You know, I read all the science fiction in the public library in Littleton, where I grew up. I ordered the books. I went down to the supermarket and bought whatever was on the newsstand. But I didn't know that there was a fanish community. I didn't know anything about that. So I'm 42, and I'd been writing for a while. And I found out that there was a magazine that published reviews of short science fiction, which was called Tangent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about this. So I emailed the editor of Tangent, Dave Truesdell, and said, you know, introduced myself. And I said, I published some stories in the last half a dozen years or so. By chance, did Tangent review any of them? I'd never seen a review. And he photocopied the reviews of every one of the stories, which I just thought was awesome. And then physically mailed me all the reviews. And then I called him to thank him. And he asked me on the phone, was I going to go to WorldCon? This was early August in '96. And I laughed at him. I said, that's conventions. That's where people dress up like Klingons, right? And he said, no. Well, okay, yeah. But that's also where writers and editors and publishers gather. It's a really good networking opportunity for writers. You really should go. So... I'd never been to a convention. I bought my membership late. I drove from Grand Junction to Los Angeles and went to the convention. So it was
That's a long drive.
Oh yeah. And it was kind of an intimidating experience too, because as I said, I'm not really a party person. So I went to the panels. That was amazing. The panels were my idols up there. There was Stan Schmidt, who had been submitting stuff to Analog and hadn't sold anything. And there was Gardner Dozois, and there was Robert Silverberg. And I went to the Ice Cream Social on the first night that I was there. So they open up these big doors in this convention hall with about 100 tables filled with ice cream and toppings by different fan groups. And I get my ice cream, and the room is just filled, and I don't know what the heck I'm doing here. And this little elderly man goes walking by me, and he's all stooped over his ice cream, which he's trying not to spill. It was Robert Forward. You go, holy moly, this is, oh my gosh. I was totally fan struck. So I had no idea what to do. I'd spent the money to get there. I had the hotel. I didn't know how to meet anybody, but I'd heard that room parties were the way to do it. So I sat down with a legal pad. I wrote down the name of every editor I'd ever submitted a story to,
yeah.
which was about 50 names. And I walked to the to room parties, and I just tried to find whoever looked like they're in charge of the party and showed them my list. And I said, is anybody on that list in the room? And I didn't meet anybody that night, but I had a lot of, great conversations. And then the next night, Dave Truesdale took me up to the Cepho Suite, and I got to see all these people, and I was just – it was awesome.
That's it was amazing. Awesome. That is amazing. So first off, I'm amazed. So were you living in Grand Junction at the time?
Yeah,
and,
I was.
And so you're already on that side of the Rockies at that point. Did you just go down through Vegas?
Yeah, I drove straight across. I burned out the car. Actually, I melted it.
Oh, my gosh.
So I made it to my aunt's house who lived in, Desert Palm Springs, which is about, 40 miles outside of Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And the car wouldn't start the next morning. And it turned out every electrical piece in it had fused into one thing inside the car. I'd killed it driving it. And so I rented a car and drove in. I think I spent the rest of the nights on the floor of Dave Truesdale's hotel room.
Really?
I may have driven back to my aunt's house once, but I spent another couple nights there.
Wow.
I was blown away by the Hugo ceremony, that the sense of history, the connection with all these greats, and to watch these folks going up and getting their awards, it was awesome. And I did. The first day I was there, I was walking from one panel to another, and this was in Anaheim, and it's the middle of August, and it was blazing hot. So I'm walking from one building to another, and there was a park bench underneath a tree. And I sat down just to get out of the heat, and there was a Klingon sitting on the bench smoking a cigarette. And he turned to me, and he said, "Do you want to smoke?" And all I could think at the time was, I'm home. I'm finally home. It was very strange.
That's funny because my very first science fiction convention was a Star Trek convention in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very small. And my best friend and I, David, we went to this thing. We had talked about it. We were very excited. And we went, and it was in this little tiny hotel off of Highway 99, and we pulled up, and I think I've told this story before in the podcast, but it's new to you. And we parked, and we got out of the car, and we start walking up, and gosh, we couldn't have been, I want to say we were probably 18 or 19 years old, and it was when Star Trek The Next Generation was big on TV, and we may have been 20. And we start walking up, and as we're walking up, there's a Borg standing outside smoking a cigarette. And to us, that was the most surreal thing we could have ever possibly seen, was a Borg smoking a cigarette. But that was
our... You know the scene in Galaxy Quest where the early in the show you see some fans going to the bathroom and mm-hmm. there's a bunch of Romulans or something at the urinal?
Yep.
I had exactly the same experience. It was very, you know, surreal is the very best term for it.
Well, to have Worldcon be your first ever convention, that's huge. That is huge.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. I was on that same first day where I saw Robert Forward, I saw David Brin walking in between panels, and I had my little program book, and I here's my opportunity. I'm not really a guy that goes for signatures
mm-hmm.
and stuff, but this was David Brin. He'd written Sundiver and oh my gosh, and The Postman, and just awesome stuff that had changed my life. So I asked him for a signature, and he wrote, "I hope you have a good time at Worldcon, David Brin." And I get my notebook back, and I walk 20 paces and run into Larry Niven. So I'm already in a role, and I asked for a signature from him, and he wrote underneath David Brin's, "Hope you have a good time at Worldcon," he wrote, "Me too."
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was quite the convention for me. I was I went for another 8 years in a row. I think I went until it went out of the country finally. Oh no, I kept going because the next one out of the country was in Melbourne. And I was a finalist for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer that year. So I wasn't going to go. It's way expensive to fly to Australia. But my dad said, well, if you're a finalist for award, you should go. I'll pay for the plane ticket. And then awesome. He looked up how much it cost, and he said, I'll pay for half of the plane ticket. So I went to Melbourne to that one, too.
Well, I told you before we started recording that I was up for Hugo when it was in London, but there was it was the same thing. I couldn't afford it. There was no way I could afford to go. And I thought at first I could go. I thought, oh, I'm just going to – it's only going to cost me this much money, and I'll be able to go. And then my girlfriend at the time was like, well, I want to go. And then I thought, oh, okay. So, you know, I'm figuring out, you know, what's that going to cost and how's that – and maybe that's doable and this and that. And my mom, who's in her 70s, lives with me now. And she's had some health issues and stuff, but she's getting better and she lives with me. And then she's like, well, I've never been out of the country before. And then I'm looking at it. I'm like, nope, I can't afford it. I cannot afford to take all these people to London. So it just never happened. But that's cool that you got to go to Melbourne.
Well, the thinking was, and I think this was pretty good thinking, is how many opportunities do you get to sit with the Hugo finalists as a finalist?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, although every time they talk about the John W. Campbell Award, they then say, not a Hugo. But just that they give you the little Hugo pin and you're treated like a Hugo finalist. So I may never be a finalist for a Hugo, but I got to sit with him once. And that was pretty cool. I went out to dinner with Stan Schmidt and shoot. Now, I don't remember who else it was. It was a novelist who was up for Hugo. And, of course, Schmidt was up for a Hugo every year because he was always on the editor shortlist. And they were both as nervous as a couple of cats. I don't think they ate anything the whole time. And Schmidt, this must have been like his 15th time up for the award.
Wow.
So it was... It's very tension provoking and it's an awesome thing, you know, regardless of what you think about the validity of a single literary award and what is good and what isn't. To win one puts you into a kind of a hall of fame and you're forever an answer to a trivia question. And it may never make you a lot of money, but it's a interesting validation.
Sure, you could end up on Jeopardy.
Exactly.
Now, unfortunately, when you were up for the John W. Campbell, that was prior to the Tiara.
Yes. Jay Lake and I talked a lot about the Campbell Award. I met Jay the next year or the year after. I don't remember. And I had started a website for Campbell-eligible authors because short stories are kind of the poor stepchild in the Campbell Award system. You can become eligible for the best new writer by making a professional sale in a short story. But novels make all the splash, and novels are what people know. So year after year, mostly novelists win the award. Mm-hmm. So I put together a website to show who was eligible for everything. And if you'd made a sale to Analog, for example, and became eligible that way, then I would list you on the website. So I had a lot of communication with Jay Lake because he was selling a lot of short fiction and had made his first professional sale. And then I met him at a convention, and he said that he had this plan to win the Campbell Award. And the plan was he was going to sell a lot of stuff in semi-pro markets so that his name became known, and then make several breakthrough sales in major markets. Well, who has a plan like that? I mean, you have no control over what the editors are going to buy, right? How can you have this plan? But that is exactly what he did. He did it and got the Campbell Award, and then created two things that are part of the Campbell Award. Now is the Campbell Award has its own pin, mm-hmm. which is beautiful. These pen nibs, you know, like for a fountain pen,
right? Yeah.
That are glued together into a side or kind of star, and it's gorgeous. And then the tiara, and it's part of his legacy.
It is.
To the field, I yes. think, besides this amazing body of short fiction that he produced in way too short of life, and a very interesting set of novels, and all the people he influenced, he gave us the tiara.
Yes, and just his spirit.
Yeah.
Because I've said this many times, when DiNardo and I went and were up for Hugo's, and we had no freaking clue what was happening. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know where to go. We didn't know anything. And then we met Jay Lake. And Jay was going through so much stuff at the time. He had just found out that the cancer was back. Mm-hmm. And he took the time to sit us down and talk to us and put his arms around us and lead us around and tell us, you know, this is where you're going to go and you're going to be here and you're going to do. And he was just the kindest person in the world. Just, he was just wonderful. And his impact, I hope, and his legacy goes on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. I actually got to talk to Wes Chu after he won the Campbell this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled him aside and I said, you know, there's a problem. And he's like, what? And I said, well, you're required to wear that tiara every day for the next year.
And he bought it.
At first, he gave me this look like, screw you. And then he just started laughing because he knew I was kidding him. But yeah. So you've had, it sounds like not only have, so I'm all over the place now. You have this whole rich, deep history with fandom. Because you are a fan yourself and you've gone to all these conventions. You've gone to Mile High Con for the last 10 to 20 years, depending on how you do your math.
Yeah.
And you're a high school teacher, so I'm really nervous about my math now. And so you have that, but you've also done things professionally. I mean, you obviously made those connections and you started selling stories.
Well, I'm not sure where the cause or the, you know, what is cause and what is effect.
Right.
I made my first professional sale of a story in 1989. I was in grad school in UC Davis doing a two-year program in creative writing. I graduated from Metro State in 78, and I'd started teaching in 81. And then I took a sabbatical and a year leave of absence from 88 to 90 to get my master's degree in creative writing. So I hadn't sold anything up to that point. I'd sold a science fiction poem to Starline in 1988. They paid me $2 for it, and I still have the check somewhere. I've never cashed that check. So I sold my first story in 89 to a little magazine called Aberrations, and then about a story a year for 6 years. And at that, having made six story sales by 1995 or so, meant that I was the envy of many of the writers I hung out with who hadn't sold anything. If you go to a convention and you go to one of the writing panels at a big convention, there might be 200 people in the room, 190 of them are wishing they would make one sale, right? Because they haven't made a sale yet at all. So I was doing this one sale at a time, but I'd never been to any of the conventions. And then in 1996, before I went to Worldcon, something weird happened. I went from one story sale a year to 96. I sold 14 stories. And I talked to Connie Willis about this later.
Who will be at Mile High Con, by the way?
Yes. And she is – if you go to Mile High Con, and you should, if you're listening,
yes.
Go – Connie Willis, anything she does, go listen to it.
Absolutely.
It will be entertaining and interesting.
Yes.
So, sorry, side note, advertisement for Connie there. But Connie said she thought maybe I'd reached critical mass. And I asked her what she meant by that. She said, well, you've sent so many things to the editors that you finally showed them how to read your stuff. And now they like it. And she said basically the same thing happened to Ray Bradbury. Because he wrote, you know, Ray Bradbury stuff. It didn't look like anybody else's stuff.
Right.
So he kept submitting it, though, and after a while, you know, the editors came around and said, well, you know, this doesn't look much like what I've seen before, but I kind of like what it is on its own. So that was her theory. I don't know if that's – I made connections at that first convention at Worldcon, which paid off later mm-hmm. in other ways. You sure. know, invitations to anthologies or people that I met who later became editors or folks who I met who said, oh, I heard of this and then told me about it. So the whole networking thing that Dave Truesdale had talked about on that first convention was absolutely true. And as a writer, it benefited me mightily to go to a convention. And not only just because of who I met, but because I got to listen to the folks who were working in the field at a higher level than I was, and I got to see them as just people. Right? So I saw Gardner Dozois and Stanley Schmidt sitting up in front of a room talking to a bunch of writers. And, you know, they weren't mystical godlike beings. They were just a couple of guys who like stories and are in position to buy stories. And that somehow gave me more courage to submit stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So there's a ton of benefits of attending a convention if you're interested on the writing side.
Oh, absolutely. And Mile High Con even has like some writing tracks and people talking about stuff. Most conventions do.
Oh yeah, there's a whole thread. If you're interested in going as a writer, there's things to do pretty much the whole convention. If you're going as somebody who loves comics, there's things to do the whole convention. You know, there's threads for every interest. If you love games, there's 24-hour gaming. You know, I talk to my kids in my science fiction class at the high school about this all the time because they have this sort of warped vision of what goes on at a convention, and because they've seen Galaxy Quest, and which I show them, by the way, but to let them know that there's always so much to do, and it's there's not only the program stuff but all this unprogrammed things. So the hallway meetup, or some writers talk about they don't even go to panels anymore. They do what they call a bar con.
Yes.
Which is they just go to sit where the other writers are sitting and network. But also,
yeah,
it's about...
I don't know anything at all about bar con, I promise.
Yeah. I've just read about it.
Yeah.
but a lot about a convention is, you know, I said when I went to Worldcon, I saw that Klingon smoking a cigarette and I felt like I'd come home. It is about feeling like you're at home.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're surrounded by people where your interest in Star Trek or Serenity and Firefly or whatever is not out of the norm. It's not – you don't feel like you have to defend the fact that you liked Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan novels, mm-hmm. or that you were a big fan of, you know, an obscure 1950s science fiction movie. You're among people who understand you. What I like best about science fiction conventions is it's the most welcoming, diverse group of people
yes.
who I ever hang out with.
Yes.
And that's what makes it exciting for me. That's why one of the many reasons I like conventions.
Agreed. So you mentioned something that blew my mind. You said in the class you teach in high school on science fiction.
Yes. Not very many high schools have.
I was going to say, where the hell were you? When I was in high school.
I wasn't where I was when I was in high school. We didn't have a science fiction class, but it's in the school district's curriculum.
That's awesome.
And I've been able to teach it. This year, actually, I need to back up a little bit. I retired this year. So I'm not teaching this year. Last year was my last year.
Congratulations on retirement.
Well, I now have to tell people I'm a full-time writer. I don't want to tell them I'm a retired teacher. I'm a full-time writer.
Exactly.
But I will go in and sub occasionally. And then I've done guest appearances in various teachers' classrooms now to talk about stuff, including science fiction classrooms.
That's still awesome. I love that. Because I was the kid that when you gave me – if you gave me certain books, I would read them. But it had to be certain books,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I'm an advocate for the whole give the kids something that they'll actually read, doesn't matter what it is kind of stuff. You know, it's like if mm-hmm. the kid will read a comic book, give them a comic book.
Right.
Get them to read. That's the big thing for me. It's like get them reading.
I had a student teacher a couple of years ago who was really big into graphic novels and manga.
Yeah. Is that? Yep, manga.
Which I have no background in graphic novels or manga at all.
I'll bring you
and,
a couple.
She educated me because she made exactly the same argument. She said, look, if you've got kids reading graphic novels, can you have a kid do a graphic novel for their independent reading? And I, you know, in theory, I was all up with it, but I didn't know anything about it. So she helped by showing me some titles and our library had a pretty extensive collection of it because our librarian was hipper on this than I was.
Mm-hmm.
I have a tough time reading graphic novels. I wasn't a big comic fan when I was young, and maybe my brain is calcified or something, but I have a hard time following narrative in a graphic novel.
No, because I know someone else, my friend JT has the same issue, and he will explain it very medically. There's something that bridges the two halves of the brain that didn't fully form for him, so he has trouble following the narrative. He can either focus on the words or focus on the pictures, but he can't do both.
Yeah, that may be my problem. I love the artwork, though.
Yeah.
Like, do you know James Owens?
Mm-mm.
He does the Star Lost series of graphic novels. I love his art. Right? And so I'll teach myself how to read it because I like how he draws things.
Sure.
It's so beautiful.
Well, and one of the reasons I do the column that I do over at Kirkus, I do a column there on graphic novels.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm trying to do is get people to look at that medium differently. It's not just superheroes. It's not just Marvel and DC. There's a ton of stuff out there that mm-hmm. is really, really good, like Saga. Or I just did one for Kirkus called Witches, and it's Witches with a Y instead of an I. Mm. And it felt like a Stephen King novel.
Hmm.
And I find out later he even blurbed it. I didn't realize that he had blurbed it and said it was fantastic. But it's just that, you know, that creepy factor that's and the art is so dark and there's so much detail. But it felt like that kind of book. And there's tons of stuff out there like that for people. Tons of it. And there's almost too much to read. You know, it's just like everything mm-hmm. else. There's right. so much to read and not enough time. Stay away from my glasses. That's a reference to the old Twilight Zone episode with Burgess Meredith, where he finally has all the time in the world and then he breaks his glasses.
One of my favorite episodes.
Everybody's favorite episode. That was awesome. So yeah, I'm all for that. I love that stuff. And, you know, I think that conventions are where you can go and you can meet people who will introduce you to things that you're going to love.
Exactly.
And which is awesome. So we haven't talked that much really about your writing, except that you started getting more sales. You started doing more short fiction sales. Have you been in like every single market out there? Have you been in Asimov's? Did you finally get into Asimov's?
I did. The whole career arc for me has been sort of awesome and surprising. The first sale to Aberrations it was a semi-pro and a chat book kind of staple stitched magazine. I think I'm still kind of walking on clouds from that acceptance because that's a really big barrier to cross from being from unpublished and, you know, does anybody other than my friends who say nice things about me because they like me think that I'm writing anything that's worth reading to have somebody pay you for your work. And that's awesome. So, but I did. I made the sale to Aberrations. And then I sold to a couple small literary magazines. And then I sold something to Dean Wesley Smith's Pulp House, which was my first professional sale. And, their stories went out and found markets. And I kind of worked my way up, I guess. I didn't really think of it that way because I was always submitting to all the markets that, you know, submit to where you best would like to appear. And I was trying to look at my list here because I actually have a list. And I sold Nine Fingers on the Flute. That was my ninth professional sale. Sold it to Adventures in Sword and Sorcery. And then the next one was a story to Analog. And I never thought that I would sell to Analog. I'd grown up reading Analog. It was the only magazine that I did read because our high school and our junior high subscribed to it. Ah. I didn't know very much about fandom or anything. So I only assumed there was this one magazine. And I didn't even know that I could subscribe to it. I thought it was a library thing. So I would go in and read that issue. And then I read all the back issues the library had. And then I was in there about every week asking for the new issue. But that was Science Fiction Analog, right? That was John W. Campbell.
Yeah.
And I was writing mostly fantasy. And then 97, Analog bought a story from me. Stan Schmidt bought a story from me. And it was called The Big One. And I went to WorldCon in 97, and I ran into a couple of Analog authors at a coffee klatch. And they invited me to sit with them. But it was kind of embarrassing because there was this group of people sitting around them, and the one of the authors said, "Oh, that's James Van Pelt. He's the big one." And I had to explain what that meant. And all the way through the convention, he was calling me the big one after that. So, and you know, after that, story sales, as I said, started to really take off. I was selling stories to Tailbones, that's Fairwood Press. And the editor there, Patrick Swenson, asked me to go to lunch with him at Mile High Con, and asked me over lunch, had I ever considered doing a short story collection, because they were doing a book line. And I tried to act very calm and collected and say, why, no, I hadn't. What do you have in mind? And we did my first collection through him. So my first book, Another Dream Comes True. You know, you sell a story, that's a dream. And now you have a book, that's a dream. And things just kept going. So Fairwood Press has been my publisher ever since. I have four short story collections with them. You mentioned them in the biography, and my two novels are both Fairwood Press books. So the new one, Pandora's Gun, which is a young adult novel, came out at WorldCon, and Summer of the Apocalypse, which is my take on a plague novel where I get to destroy Denver, came out in 2006.
So I you mentioned something in passing that I want to kind of touch on.
Sure.
You have been going to Worldcon for a very long time. It was your very first convention, and you went there not knowing really anything about it. And you had all these wonderful adventures, and you met all these wonderful people. And I feel, just from listening to you, that kickstarted your career. And from then on, you were just, you know, I think you got a little bit more focused, and you were writing more, and then you started selling stuff. And now, when was the first Worldcon you went to?
96, Anaheim.
96. So I'm going to do the math correctly almost and say 20 years later, you had a book launch party at Worldcon for Pandora's Gun.
I did.
That is awesome. That is wonderful.
Did you go to the historic Davenport? That was where the parties were.
I was. For a lot of them. Yes, I did. Yeah. One of my frustrations with Worldcon this year was the same frustration I had with Reno, was, you know, everything was so spread out. But they added a level of complexity to that, in that people would say, yes, we're going to be at the Davenport, meet us there, and then they'd walk away. And I didn't know.
There were three Davenports.
There were four.
Oh, were there four?
There were four. No. There's a fourth one. So there was the historic, the tower, the grand, and I always forget what the fourth one was called, so I'm just calling it Isengard. But yes,
well,
I was at that
historic
one. The historic, which was gorgeous.
That's a beautiful motel.
It was gorgeous on the inside, yes.
So that's where the party was.
Okay.
Fairwood Press had rented a suite, so we had a really big room.
Nice.
Brenda Cooper.
I love Brenda.
And Louise Marley and Ken Scholes also had books that all debuted from Fairwood Press at World.
That's
so
awesome.
We had all four authors and the books in the room, and I spent the whole night there talking to people and signing books, and all sorts of folks came through the party. I'd never done that. It really felt like a big deal. It was quite exciting.
That is amazing, and I'm so happy for you, because it almost feels like it's bringing it full circle. You know, I mean, that's huge.
I thought so.
Yeah, you had a book launch party at Worldcon. Come on. Yeah, my experience going over to the historic was that my friend JT and I were trying to get there, and by the time we got there, the party that we wanted to go to was over.
Oh. Well, there were other parties, though, right? There were other things you could do.
There were, but it was just funny that, you know, by the time we figured out where we were going and got there, it was all over. Anyway, so
I was reading Rich Horton's blog. Rich knows everything there is to know about short fiction, I think, because he reads it all. And he had said that he was at the old Davenport, I think, on Saturday night till 4 a.m. So there were parties going on that he was at the whole time.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't surprise me at all. Well, I went to the they're trying to get the WesterCon in Denver.
In Denver. Yeah, I went to that one.
I was at that party for a little while.
Oh, we might have even been in the same room.
We may have been, but there was a lot of people in there, and it was a small room. So, because they didn't move the bed out. They should have moved that gigantic bed out. That would have been cool.
Yeah.
So let's talk for just a second about Pandora's Gun.
Yeah. Okay.
What's the book about?
It's about a high school kid who likes digging in junkyards and he finds a piece of technology that he's not supposed to have.
Okay.
And things unfold after that. It turns out that the junkyard that he's digging around in is not a human's junkyard.
Ooh.
It's a kind of an accidental junkyard. So what he finds is not, it's a bit of alien technology. And after that, things take off.
Yeah, it says, the blurb here says, what would you do if you controlled powers that were once attributed to the gods?
Yeah, it's a really neat piece of technology. it's sort of like, you know, you hear people making jokes about there's an app for that.
Yep.
The piece of technology he has some really awesome apps.
Very cool. Well, I'm looking at the cover here online. That looks very awesome. Who did your cover?
That is an Estonian artist. Patrick Swenson at Fairwood is really good at getting art for covers, and he goes pretty far afield to find the artists. My short story collection, Flying in the Heart of the Lafayette Escadrille, is a Russian artist.
Ooh, okay.
So this is it was not a piece of art commissioned for it, but it worked perfectly for the book.
Hmm.
So we negotiated with the artist and ended up with the cover.
And that's amazing. And that's available now. People can go out and buy that.
Yes. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. Can be ordered both electronically and in a hard copy.
And are you going to have any at Mile High Con with you?
Yes. Fairwood Press will have a table there. But also Who Else Books, which is just an awesome book source. They may not have Pandora's Gun. I'm not sure, because Fairwood Press will be there, and it's kind of debuting, so it might be just at the Fairwood Press table. But Who Else Books has all the rest of them too. So those are the two big booksellers for me. Those are the ones I'll be thinking of. There are other booksellers in the dealer's room. So if you go to the convention, take your credit card.
Yes. I actually sold some stuff for people last year in the first like half hour of the dealer's room being open. I walked some people around and ended up buying stuff. The who else? That's the folks up on Broadway?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Ron and Nina Else.
Mm-hmm.
They're just awesome. They really support Colorado authors. They do all kinds of things at their store for authors, book signings, book releases, talks, readings. They go to conventions and bring all the authors' books. They're great people.
And they do make a point at Mile High Con of having books from the authors who are going to be there, which is awesome.
Right. Yeah, they will feature them.
Yeah, so it's a great opportunity. If you have been listening to this awesome interview with Jim and you want to get an autograph from him, you can go in the dealer's room, get a book, and walk up to him and say, would you mind signing this for me? And, you know, he'll probably personalize it for you and say something along the lines of, I hope you have fun at the con.
When I was at, I probably will, or I'll just write me too. I'll do that. I did there was a literacy auction at Mile High. They have this every year, but
yes,
they were doing a first edition of Connie Willis's Lincoln's Dreams,
ooh,
which is a completely awesome book, just a totally awesome book. And I really wanted to have the book, but I was sitting next to Connie during the auction. So I'm bidding on it and she's sitting right there. So, you know, it's kind of, I don't know. Kind of cool. It was probably weird for her to have somebody bidding for a book who was sitting right. I could go to the dealer's room and buy it for $5, but here I'm up to $25 or something for the book. And I said, if I get this book, I'd like you to personalize it for me. And she said, of course. And I said, no, you don't understand. I want you to write in the cover your three best writing tips. And then, you know, to me. And she did. And it was just awesome. And I remember the tips, but the tip I thought was most interesting was never kill the dog. That was one of her tips. And we talked a lot about what that meant afterwards, and it was a pretty awesome tip.
Wow. Well, Jim, believe it or not, I mean, we have run over the time that I promised because you're such a wonderful guest, and I'm having such a great time chatting with you. But I do need to let you go because I've run way over the time that I promised.
Oh, well, I'm flattered that I can talk.
Well, you have such great stories, and so I'm gonna encourage people who are listening who are gonna be in the Denver area to please come to Mile High Con and walk up to Jim and say hello and just hopefully get you to tell some of these stories because they're wonderful.
All right, thank you.
And is, you know, since this is sort of the end of the podcast, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners before I let you go?
Well, I am doing a writing experiment. If I have writers that are listening,
sure,
you might think about this. I've been writing since since the 70s. I started writing, but I really got serious about it in the late 80s when I was in my late 20s. And I had read a piece of advice from Ray Bradbury. And Bradbury had said that you should, if you're a new writer, a young writer, you should write a story a week for a year. And then he said, because it's impossible to tell 52 bad stories in a row. I thought that was great. Well, I'd never done that. And now that I have retired, I decided I was going to give that a try. So
you mean now that you've become a full-time author?
Yeah. Okay. So in March, I started. And I'm working on the 29th story right now. And it's been an awesome experience trying to write a full short story a week for all this time. So I'm over 6 months of writing a story a week. It's been an awesome experience. So I recommend it. There are things you can do if you're a writer and you're trying to improve and grow your craft that can be really proactive. That's a lot different from all the people you meet sometimes in writing groups and sometimes at conventions who say, I want to be a writer. And then they talk to you about all the times that you're not writing yet. So if you want to write, you need to be writing. This story a week thing is fun. I'm not sure it's for everybody, but I think I'm learning stuff about my own craft by doing it.
That's amazing.
So I'm glad I was able to mention that.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully you and I can hook up at Mile High Con and say hello.
Absolutely. We'll have to find out about this bar con, whatever
yeah,
that is.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never, I first I've heard of it. First I've heard of it ever. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
It's like talking to a child.
Magic Wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
I don't even know what the horseman is.
And scene, you bastard.